Listening Library presents Socrates, A Life Worth Living by Devra Lehman. Read for you by Robert Petkoff. Prologue. Even now, in his final hours in a grim prison cell, Socrates kept asking his questions. About 15 men had occupied the room since the early morning, their dread steadily mounting as the sun made its course across the sky. But Socrates had engaged his visitors in such animated conversation, and his manner had been so probing, so lively, so full of good cheer, in short, so much the way it always was, that he had turned the day into a curious sort of celebration. His friends had almost forgotten where they were and what was about to occur. For years, these men had followed Socrates around Athens. He had drawn them into spirited discussions in the marketplace and craftsmen's workshops, the athletic facilities and judicial precincts, the homes of wealthy men, and the shady banks of a river. Most of these friends were locals, but others had come from far away to seek him out. And they were not the only ones who had flocked to his side. Socrates engaged trendsetters and intellectuals, aristocrats and slaves, shoemakers, ne'er-do-wells, artists, politicians, writers, and even occasionally a woman, unusual at a time when public life was almost exclusively male. These individuals had not come to him for answers, for he had surprisingly few of those to give. Instead, he offered questions and the opportunity to think. What is virtue? What is friendship? What is beauty? All of that was coming to an end. The visitors had nurtured their hopes for several weeks, but the last rays of light were fading in the west, and now the outcome was inevitable. Socrates, their dear friend, was about to die. They could already hear the prison official making his way down the passage that ran between the rows of cells. The man's steps were slow and deliberate, but soon enough he appeared in the doorway, careful not to spill the liquid in the clay cup he was holding. The visitors closest to him instinctively drew away. The cup was small, but the poison it contained would kill even the strongest man within minutes. Only the prisoner, sitting on his bed, maintained his composure. "Well, my good man," Socrates said, "you are an expert in this. What must one do?" So began the final moments of the philosopher's life. Ever since it was first set into words by Socrates' most famous follower, Plato, the scene has inspired countless writers and artists. Even people who know virtually nothing else about Socrates have heard of his fatal ingestion of hemlock in a prison cell in Athens. Perhaps they know, too, of the legal proceedings that led to that final scene, the accusation that Socrates had spurned the gods and corrupted the youth of Athens, the fervent speech that Socrates delivered before a packed and unruly courtroom, the majority vote of the jury to declare him guilty, and the jury's subsequent decision, with an even larger majority, to impose the death penalty. Courtroom drama is riveting, and willing martyrdom is poignant. But it would be a disservice both to Socrates and ourselves to focus only on the end of his story. Socrates lived during one of the most glorious periods in history, the lightning flash of a few decades when Athens blazed onto the scene as a democracy, an international power, and a center of art and thought. He was a vital part of that spectacular setting, which shaped him and which he shaped in return. And although he didn't quite invent philosophy, he set Western thought on a radically new course, which it has followed ever since. These are the usual reasons for learning about bygone men and women. They lived in important times, thought important thoughts, performed important deeds. If we care about how the past influences who we are today, these matters are well worth our attention. But what makes Socrates especially compelling is the way he leaps out of the past. His questions and his search for answers are as vital today as they ever were. They are vital because they all lead to what, for Socrates, was the ultimate question, one too precious for any of us to leave to chance. How can we construct lives of meaning? Socrates believed that to live meaningfully, we must pursue what is good and true. Obviously, if we are to engage in that pursuit, we must first be able to identify which things are good and true and which things are not. Our starting point, in other words, must be careful thinking. Only reason yields the knowledge that we need to make moral decisions, and only moral decisions, in their totality, create a life of meaning. Socrates exhibited a breathtaking integrity as he pursued his own life of meaning, even as the world he knew began to crumble around him. Almost 2,500 years later, his personal example has lost none of its power or relevance. Part 1. The Path to the Questions. Chapter 1. The City of Gods and Humans. 70 years before that scene in the Athenian state prison, a man named Sophroniscus and a woman named Phanerete festooned the doorway of their home with an olive wreath. The year was approximately 469 BCE, and the place was the deme, or district, of Alopeki, part of the polis, or city-state, of Athens. The polis occupied the eastern Greek peninsula known as Attica, and its nucleus, the large city that was also called Athens, was a mere mile or so to the northwest of the couple's home. The decoration on the couple's door was an announcement. Phanerete had given birth to a boy. The baby received his name when he was 10 days old, once he had proven strong enough to survive the perils of newborn life. Sophroniscus and Phanerete chose Socrates, which combined the notion of wholeness, sos, and power, kratos. The gods must have been favorably disposed. As he grew, the boy showed every sign of strength and intelligence. Although with his thick lips, flat nose, broad nostrils, and wide-set bulging eyes, he would never be handsome. Sophroniscus, as far as we know, was a stonecutter. Like other workmen, he probably maintained his workshop in a front room of the house, but if he followed the usual pattern, he had little to do with the early rearing of his son. For most Athenian men, home was a place for eating, sleeping, and recovering from illness. The real business of life, beyond the need to make a living, consisted of gathering in the public spaces of the city for conversation, political activity, and athletic pursuits. Phanerete's life was completely different. Like other women, she mostly stayed at home, where she engaged in the endless tasks of maintaining the household. As she spun, wove, and sewed to produce the family's clothing, Socrates played at her feet. The little boy's everyday life was constricted and dark. The mud-brick house contained only the barest essentials, and the unglazed windows were usually shuttered to keep out the sun and rain. But Socrates soon understood that he was part of a much bigger, more wondrous world. He learned that his family descended from Daedalus, the greatest human craftsman who had ever lived. The same Daedalus who had cleverly fashioned two sets of wings so that he and his son Icarus could escape the evil king Minos on the island of Crete. The story ended sadly with the tragic death of Icarus, but Daedalus was a brilliant inventor, certainly a worthy man to have as an ancestor. And since Daedalus was the descendant of another craftsman, the metal-working god Hephaestus, and Hephaestus was the son of Zeus, Socrates could trace his ancestry all the way back to the most powerful god of all. There were a great many gods, and they were everywhere. Socrates' home, like every other one in Athens, featured an altar to Hestia, the goddess of the hearth, and temples and shrines to one deity or another dotted the city and countryside. Even the naked landscape spoke of the god's presence. The cone-shaped Mount Lycavetus, to the northeast of Socrates' home, was more than just a stony protrusion on the Athenian plain. It was really a rock that Athena, the goddess of wisdom, had accidentally dropped when she heard some bad news.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?